from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, UC Berkeley announced that it was canceling a scheduled speech by conservative pundit Ann Coulter, citing security concerns. But last night, Coulter told Fox News she still plans to speak.
And by the way, I am giving the speech. I don't know. What are they going to do, arrest me? They can put me in the Birmingham jail.
UC President Janet Napolitano is in studio this hour. We'll get her take on the speech cancellation and the UC system struggles with controversial speakers. We'll also talk with her about ongoing issues surrounding sexual misconduct at multiple UC campuses. It's all coming up on Forum right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Janet Napolitano joins us this opening Forum hour. She, of course, is president of the University of California, former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, a position she held from 2009 to 2013. And we're going to talk about a whole range of things. And President Napolitano, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Let's begin by talking about what, of course, is splashing across the headlines, and I'm talking about UC Berkeley's decision to cancel a speech by conservative pundit Ann Coulter, citing security concerns. Coulter told the Washington Post that the university had been trying to force her to cancel her speech by, I'm quoting her now, imposing ridiculous demands on her, but she still agreed to, quoting her again, all of their silly requirements. And she said the university insisted her speech take place in the middle of the day, that only students could attend, and the exact venue wouldn't be announced until the last minute. And she said she agreed with those conditions, but that apparently wasn't good enough. So she said she believes her speech has been unconstitutionally banned by public taxpayer-supported UC Berkeley. We might as well get into this because we just had Milo Yiannopoulos and that whole controversy. It's going on at the University of Alabama. She constitutionally protected here? She even said she'd bring Attorney General Sessions into it.
Well, her speech is constitutionally protected, as objectionable as it is. But, you know, Berkeley has a responsibility to protect the safety of students and the audience and Ann Coulter. And it was the considered decision of the campus police that a venue where she could be sufficiently protected was not available on the scheduled date. So they offered to reschedule.
And she said she would go along with that, according to her testimony so far?
Well, if she will work with us, we can reschedule, and it will be at a suitable, protectable venue on the campus.
Is there a double standard, though, for conservative speakers, on, as some have been suggesting? In fact, the Young Americans for Freedom, the group that sponsored her speech, said this is like Kim Jong-un. I mean, this is kind of a ridiculous analogy. But they're saying, in other words, you're not giving them the right to have speakers come and say what they want them, what students to hear.
No, I think it's more an analysis of the intelligence of what kinds of protests are planned and who is going to be doing the protesting and the likelihood, unfortunately, that there could be violence. But Berkeley is a free speech venue and sponsors lots of speakers that you can object to their views. So in this particular case, safety was the predominant concern.
But when free speech is brought into the concern, and President Trump has even said there shouldn't be federal funds for those who do not allow free speech, they're making it a free speech issue.
Like I said, this is really a scheduling and safety issue. And the university at no point has said that it wants to cancel Coulter's speech. It said it wants to reschedule it so that it could be at a venue that can be protected and that's available.
I'm sure we'll hear from listeners on this one way or the other. But in the future, that is going to be, is there a firm position here? Is there something that you're sort of digging into when you say security is the number one concern?
Well, safety. And again, it's safety of our students, safety of the audience, and safety of the speaker herself. And the police have to take that all into account.
Let's talk about a recent lawsuit that was just settled over the former dean of the law school and an assistant of his who the settlement was made by the Regents. The assistant had charged him with sexual harassment, and he had countersued and essentially this has gone away now. Both sides agreed to the settlement. But the young woman said that it was a soft landing, she described it. She said privilege, again, helps privilege. It's an insult to people who have suffered sexual harassment that it didn't go farther, that the university didn't do enough.
Well, again, she knew the terms of the settlement when she agreed to it. And the former dean is the former dean. And he basically is not teaching. He has access to some research funds for a year, but is not being paid. And then will leave the faculty.
You have several more lawsuits, and you also have recently coming out that highly respected, iconic philosophy emeritus professor John Searle has been charged with sexual harassment.
Right, and the campus has taken interim measures with respect to Professor Searle. He is not teaching, and they're conducting a complete investigation. And I think that the point is that we want our campuses to be free of sexual harassment. These cases need to be handled expeditiously and fairly and firmly, and there need to be consequences when the allegations are substantiated.
Well, when we had the Graham Fleming case and the Jeff Marcy case, there was a good deal of public concern that maybe not enough had been done in those cases and not enough was being done. Dan Mogiloff, who's a spokesman for UC Berkeley, was saying this is unfair for the public to see things this way, that a lot has been done. You'd agree with that?
A lot has been done, and a lot has been done post-Marcy and post-Fleming. But we have totally redone the framework with respect to how we handle cases of alleged harassment involving students, involving faculty, involving staff. We've created the first system-wide Title IX coordinator position. To give me a direct report who monitors what the campuses are doing to implement the new frameworks. And, you know, really the emphasis now needs to be on prevention, that this kind of behavior just needs to stop.
Again, if you've just joined us in this opening hour, Janet Napolitano is here with us in studio. She is a president of the University of California and former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. And we're going to, of course, offer you an opportunity to speak with President Napolitano this hour. I wanted to go into a number of other things, though, with you. 20% cap on out-of-state students. This is the first of its kind, and it seems to be at this point maybe fait accompli. The state will release money if this goes through.
Well, as part of last year's Budget Act, the legislature required the regents to adopt an out-of-state policy. Whether it will be 20% or something lower is still in dialogue with the legislature about. You know, the idea is that the University of California should be for Californians. However, we get a lot of value from out-of-state and international students. They contribute to the diversity of our campuses. They contribute to the intellectual life of our campuses. And frankly, they contribute extra
more to the
revenue.
Coffers. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we have been able to sustain a significant increase in California enrollment by virtue of the non-resident tuition that gets paid.
Well, when the audit took place, there was apparently a characterization of too many out-of-state students. You disagreed with that? Still disagree with that?
We do. We disagree with a lot of the findings in that audit. And again, out-of-state international students, we've always had them, and we always will. They contribute to the diversity of thought on the campuses. Our students are primarily Californians. The out-of-state enrollment percentage is something around 16%. And, you know, we want to be open and accessible to Californians while recognizing the value of out-of-state and international students.
And you just said international students as well. And it does certainly, you hear a lot of professors as well as students say they're exposed to students from other countries. This is great for diversity, for learning purposes, just interacting with them. But you also hear from people who say, how do you get into a UC? You know, my kid had 4-point average. My kid had great SATs and so forth, couldn't get into a UC. Especially hear this about UCLA, which is now, I guess, the first university in the country to have over 100,000 freshman applicants. I mean, the numbers are extraordinary. They're almost exponential. But What do you say to those people who say, what do you need to get into these UCs?
Well, you need you need good grades, and you need to show the potential to succeed at the university. But the key driver of in-state enrollment is not the presence of out-of-state or international students. It's how much funding the state contributes to support enrollment. So last year, when the state put in extra money to increase enrollment, we were able to have the largest increase in in-state enrollment since World War II, and we are on a growth trajectory. So, like I say, the doors of the University of California are open, and we are meeting our obligations under the master plan.
And you still feel that tuition hikes are necessary to sustain quality?
Unfortunately, yes. For the first time in 6 years, the board approved a small tuition increase, 2.5%, and that will go right into kind of the academic excellence mission of the university.
There's also a couple of new leaders in the UC system at Berkeley as well as at Davis. Can we talk about them?
Sure. Gary May will be the next chancellor at Davis. He's the dean of the College of Engineering at Georgia Tech, well-known in particularly in respect to diversity and increased efforts with respect to diversity of students and faculty.
He got an award from President Obama, in fact, for what he did at Georgia Tech with minorities. And he's African-American.
Yes, he's African-American. And he had a remarkable record there. And I think he will do a wonderful job at Davis, which is a gem of a campus. And then Carol Crist will be the next chancellor at Berkeley. She's the acting provost there now, and a longtime Berkeley faculty member, left for a while to be the president of Smith College in Massachusetts, where she had a tremendous record, and now will become the next chancellor.
She's come home, and you seem pleased, and the cloud of Linda Katehi or whatever difficulties came under Nick Dirks, gone?
I think we're ready for new chapters in both campuses.
Speaking about new chapters, David Horowitz has called for defunding of sanctuary universities and for your ouster. He said you should be put on trial for sedition. You want to comment on that?
Yeah. Well, he's kind of a piece of work. Shortly after the election, we did enunciate some principles that we believe the University of California stands for. And we are inclusive campuses, and we want to be safe campuses for our undocumented students, of whom we have several thousand. So we announced that our police would not serve as surrogate immigration agencies, that we would not voluntarily turn over student records, that our health centers would be open to any patient, regardless of their documented or undocumented status. We continue to support our undocumented students in a variety of ways.
Isn't it ironic when you came here, you were taking all this heat about not being supportive enough to the undocumented, and now it's coming from the other side?
Yeah, that's immigration for you. And what I've always believed in is the rule of law. In this instance, where many of our students are in DACA, they are and have been awarded status to have any immigration action deferred. They have work authorization. And while we cannot do much for their families, we can certainly send a message with respect to our students.
Can I ask you about your health? I mean, you've been public about the struggle with cancer, and it's pretty much behind you?
Yes, I've gotten excellent treatment. I've been undergoing treatment this entire past year, and I'm doing well. So thank you for asking.
Good. Glad to hear that. Let's also talk about some more good things. With Vox, there was an announcement just yesterday that 6-episode video series exploring climate change and UC are going to be essentially working on, well, investigating and talking about the effects of climate change.
Right. And it's a great series, and it highlights our efforts in the climate change area, our research to create scalable solutions, our university-wide goal to be carbon neutral ourselves by 2025, which is a very aggressive goal. But we believe that we should lead by example, that we should ourselves be good stewards of our environment, and that our research can contribute to truly global solutions to this impending crisis.
There's also a lot of excitement that's building on this UC Mexico initiative. Can I get you to talk about that? There are millions of dollars involved, and what is it exactly?
Right. So it is our partnership with leading institutions of higher ed in Mexico to foster student exchange, joint faculty research. You know, out of the recognition by virtue of history and geography and economy and an environment, California and Mexico share a lot, and that the university can play a lead role in that linkage. And so I was recently in Mexico City, where the Mexican equivalent of our Department of Energy announced a $10 million grant proposal for research in energy efficiency, where one of the partners must be the University of California.
There was just a story on NPR this morning about corruption in Mexico, and it's pretty pervasive. And somebody was arrested, a governor of a state in Guatemala, millions of dollars.
Yeah, the governor of Veracruz.
Yeah, the governor of Veracruz, exactly. And then you have the president of the United States talking about, you know, building a wall and so forth. I mean, are these kinds of things obstacles when you're building an initiative of this sort?
Well, certainly when I was in Mexico City, there was a lot of talk about the president and building a wall. And I've been a long-standing opponent of a wall when I was governor of Arizona, also a border state. I was known for saying, you show me an 11-foot wall, I'll show you a 12-foot ladder, that a wall itself is not an immigration strategy.
You've been also critical of President Trump, particularly when he came out critical of the intelligence agencies. And to some extent, how does that work for your role? I mean, you're now the president of the UC system, but people realize you were a former governor. You're also former head of Homeland Security. Sometimes maybe it all kind of aggregates or gets a little colluded.
Right. So I try to keep the roles separate. And when I'm speaking as the former secretary of Homeland Security, I try to be very clear. I'm speaking in that role and not on behalf of the University of California. But, yeah, I did make some comments about the president's criticism of the intelligence network and his reluctance to take the daily brief, et cetera. We live in a fast-moving, complicated world, and our intelligence community is the best in the world, and he ought to use it.
Yeah, you really gave a great validation to the intelligence community. Does that include James Comey and the FBI?
Yeah, the FBI is a very effective counterterrorism agency.
You know, he's been hit from both sides politically.
Right, and understandably. And, I'm not going to comment on how he handled election matters, but I will say that when you have the FBI and the CIA and the DNI and the whole alphabet of national intelligence concluding that Russia was actively involved in our 2016 election, that's a real shot across the bow to our democracy, and it merits the most serious investigation.
If you just joined us, Jenna Napolitano is with us in studio, and she is president of the University of California, and also former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. We do welcome your involvement in the program. Much to talk about here. We started off talking about Ann Coulter's appearance, non-appearance, still up in the air, and the whole question of the constitutionality of free speech and how that may play in. But we've been talking about tuition hikes. We've been talking really about getting admitted into UC and the whole nature of admitting students from out of state or international students, the numbers that are involved in that, the initiative with Mexico. You may want to comment on any of these or other matters that we've taken up, and we do welcome your calls, any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available, and that number is 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email any comments or questions you have. Forum@kqed.org is our email address. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Looking at a tweet Here, President Napolitano from Larry, who says, even though the in-state commitment is kept, increased numbers of out-of-state students means a housing crunch, impacted classes, and longer time to graduation.
Our time to graduation is very good. Two-thirds of our students will graduate in 4 years and close to 90% within six. And we're working on that 6-4 student population now. In terms of housing crunch, yeah, there is a housing crunch, but that's mostly due to the increase in in-state students that we've had, which I mentioned has been very robust this year. And we anticipate more student growth. So we have a housing initiative underway whereby we intend to add 14,000 more beds at a minimum by the year 2020. Those housing beds will be particularly centered on the campuses where the crunch is most noticeable.
That means more construction?
It means more construction and public-private partnerships. We are not using our own debt capacity to build housing, but we are using the market to help us construct that housing.
Another comment from a listener. I'd like your response. Robert writes, when I see the chancellors of UC Berkeley and Davis commit misdeeds and lose their positions but otherwise be rewarded financially with new prestigious positions, I feel disgusted. Don't ask this Berkeley alum for donations.
I'm sorry that the writer feels that way. What we try to do is be very fair in terms of how we separate chancellors. In both the cases that were referenced, Davis and Berkeley, the chancellors are returning to tenured faculty positions, which they are entitled to do.
John writes, why do illegal immigrants get in-state tuition rates while a school receiving federal tax dollars charges out-of-state rates to U.S. citizens?
That's California state policy, and California was one of the first states to say that in-state undocumented students, who, by the way, have done, you know, all we have asked of them as they've grown up, have achieved academically sufficiently to get into the UC. I think there's a feeling that they shouldn't be punished for their undocumented status. And so they are entitled to in-state tuition.
Do you have any position on the Dreamers?
Yeah, I hope that their status becomes codified in law because the current DACA program was an executive action that I took when I was secretary. It was created by the Office of the Secretary of Homeland Security. And while the current administration has indicated that they have sympathy for Dreamers, that could be unwritten with a stroke of a pen. And so that uncertainty itself adds to a lot of stress.
You want it in the law. You want it in cement.
Indeed.
Yeah. Again, if you've just joined us, our guest this hour is Janet Napolitano. She's here in studio. We're checking in with the president of the UC system. And you can indeed bring your questions or comments forth. You can join us by toll-free number 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum@kqed.org or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're joined this hour by Janet Napolitano, who is, of course, president of the University of California, and discussing a number of things, UC System's ongoing efforts to mitigate sexual misconduct by faculty, the possibility of an enrollment cap for out-of-state students, and the newly hired chancellor of UC Davis and of UC Berkeley, and also talking with her about Mexico-UC partnership. She was just there, in fact, on a recent trip. And if you have questions for UC President, please feel free to ask them. We started off talking about Ann Coulter, and there are a number of callers and listeners who want to go there. I think first caller, Steve, wants to go there. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi. I want to make clear I don't approve of Ms. Coulter's politics at all, but if what venues are available on campus, regardless of the date, where she could be and the audience is protected, because if there really isn't a facility, this we need a facility and an open date is really just hogwash. Where if there really are facilities, it seems like very quickly the Young Republican Club could trade dates and get that facility. So what are facilities on Berkeley campus where she can speak?
Right. So there is at least one that's been identified and will be discussed with the Young Republicans. And Again, I think we're at the time of the academic year where we're going to be heading into finals, et cetera. And so the proposed reschedule is in the fall when students are back in class and can attend.
And let me thank the caller. By the way, getting a lot of comments on that. Let me just give you a sampling. Emily says the university is doing the right thing. Normalizing someone like Ann Coulter is not consistent with an institution that disseminates knowledge. Another listener writes, Janet Napolitano was once Secretary of Homeland Security. Why can't UC Berkeley provide enough security to let Ann Coulter speak on campus?
To the second question, the answer is that that's a campus specific analysis of what it will take, whether they'll need to call in law enforcement departments from neighboring communities, which in all likelihood they will. Unfortunately, she's the type of speaker that evokes a strong response, and the campus really feels that her safety is at issue, which is why they made the decision they did.
Another listener says, canceling the engagement for student safety concerns is a vacuous reason. I suspect the true reason is the cost from damages caused by the anti-fascists, which the university should not incur. Institute a policy requiring sponsors to obtain the necessary security and insurance for the event. What about that insurance?
Well, I think we do at Berkeley require a security fee to be paid by the sponsoring organization, but these are student organizations, and so having them bear the full true cost of security would itself be a barrier. So, again, the campus is trying to strike the right balance.
Well, the other point, though, kind of the subtext of that remark is damage is going to be done just like it was done recently. You had a call, in fact, the Alameda police and so forth. It was predictable when you have Trump and anti-Trump forces, and this would be predictable, too. It would mean damage to property and probably violence.
Indeed. And so all the more reason why the campus took or made the decision it did, which is that they didn't have a venue on the 27th, which is when she was scheduled, that they felt that they could secure. They have an alternative venue in mind, and they're going to be offering it up for the fall.
Does it ever sort of rankle you, though, when it's thrown up, this is the bastion of free speech, you know, the history of Berkeley and all that?
Absolutely. And that's a value that Berkeley holds dear. But free speech also means reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. That's the law. And that's what Berkeley is trying to do is strike that balance. And again, safety is a concern.
More of your calls. Let me go next to Marla. Good morning. Excuse me, Maria. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Sorry. Hi, it's me. Good morning. Good morning, Ms. Napolitano. I have a question for you. My son is applying to college, and we have been in the Bay Area for 2 years now, having moved from the state of Arizona. And I understand that he has been considered and that he also does as an out-of-state student, and so he doesn't qualify for in-state tuition, due to the fact that we've only been here for 2 years. And I wanted to know what comments you have on that and if there is any way around it as well.
In-state residency is something that we have a policy on, and it does require a certain period of residency to claim that in-state tuition. So it would require the Board of Regents to revisit that policy.
And we thank you, Maria, for the call. Good luck. And go to another caller in Campbell. Dan, you're on.
Yes, I have one comment and one question. The comment is the UCs are still very accessible if you are willing to attend the less prestigious ones. And I would like to say that they are, in many ways, the education there just as good as at the flagship ones, with some notable exceptions, name recognition, and maybe the access to certain high-quality academics. But by the same token, my son went to UC Santa Cruz. He had access to his professors, wasn't taught by the TAs. So it all depends on the kind of education you're looking for. The question that I have is, it appears, looking at the data that's made public for GPA and SAT, that the magic number appears to be for UC Berkeley and UCLA a 3.85 GPA and above, for most applicants. I was wondering if that's an accurate impression that I have.
You know, I haven't looked at the data recently. It sounds about right. The admissions staff actually, every campus has an admissions committee and who read all the thousands of applications. And they actually look at 14 different factors because we do what's called a comprehensive review of all the applicants. So while GPA is important, it's not the only factor taken into consideration.
And let me thank the caller, and we'll go to more of your calls in a moment. I'm just wondering, though, President Napolitano, you were talking about building more housing, all those beds that are in the works. I guess there's consideration of building in People's Park, and that's, of course, where the protests were back in 1969, Bloody Thursday. It's a symbol for many people of free speech. What about that? I mean, why build housing there? It's identified with social justice and all the rest.
Well, I think Berkeley is landlocked, and the demand for housing is very high. So they're looking at several options, and People's Park is merely one of the options they're looking at.
I think we've got a question about housing here, and that's from Iris. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. And Ms. President, I live in a community that is, in a direct relationship with the university and is currently negatively impacted by the university and a number of factors. But I'm curious, how do you work with local municipalities and local communities when the university decides to increase enrollment to make sure that you mitigate the negative impacts on the community so that the influx of students isn't driving out the local population who, frankly, can't afford the rents that we're currently facing in the Bay Area and are looking at even higher rent costs when the student population is driven up?
Right. So each campus works directly with the local communities in which they're located when they're considering a housing addition. Also with respect to planned campus growth. So there is that linkage with local communities, and you're right that there can be negative impacts or also positive impacts by the presence of the university. Students tend to bring with them a lot of surrounding services and jobs, and the universities themselves are job creators. So most communities in the state of California would love to have a UC campus in their midst because it's no surprise that the areas of California that are doing the best economically are those areas where there's a UC.
Are there any UCs that are especially maybe almost a paradigm for town and gown relations or for the connection between the city that they're in and the university?
Well, we're working well with the new mayor of Berkeley. In Davis, we have a very close connection. Actually, all of them. I was just in Merced and had lunch with the chancellor, the mayor, and the city manager because downtown Merced is getting ready to boom based on the planned growth of UC Merced.
Yeah, I was speaking about diversity. Merced is one of those universities that doesn't really have much diversity, does it?
It depends on what you mean by diversity.
Well, the numbers are really low. I mean, it doesn't necessarily attract students of color, for example.
Oh, no, to the contrary.
Really?
It's one of our most diverse campuses. It's got, I think, 60% of the students are first-generation students. It's got one of our highest, if not the highest percentage of Latino students. It's educating those young people who grew up in the valley, and it's doing exactly what it was intended to do. So it's a very diverse campus.
Some question here from Paul. Can the president explain how intellectual property developed on UC campuses is monetized for the benefit of the university? Private universities seem to have an advantage.
Monetize our intellectual property in a variety of different ways. We do it through licensing, through royalty agreements, through taking equity in startups that emerge using our IP. It really is handled on a campus by campus basis.
And Anna wants to know, what's the justification for exempting Cal, UCLA, and UC San Diego from the 20% out-of-state enrollment cap? Our kids deserve to go to these schools, too, yet they are increasingly out of reach.
Well, the justification is primarily fiscal in nature. Those campuses have grown to rely on the extra revenue produced by out-of-state and international students. And again, I have to emphasize that they all three of those campuses took a big swath of our growth in in-state enrollment this year, and that was funded in part by the out-of-state student tuition.
Talking with Janet Napolitano, president of the University of California, and let's have Miriam on the air here with us. Miriam, welcome. You're on Forum.
President Napolitano, I'm wondering if you can help clear up my confusion. Given your background as a former state attorney general and now president of the UC system, I've never understood why college campuses and universities have set up a completely separate judicial or quasi-judicial system for addressing sexual harassment and rape on campuses. Can you explain the rationale for having a completely separate system from the regular judicial system, and comment on whether you agree with that rationale?
Well, the rationale is founded on Title IX of the federal law, which requires equal access to education, and that has been interpreted to mean access to education free of sexual harassment or sexual violence. We depend a lot on a 2011 guidance letter from the Department of Education. And the reason for the two different systems is they're evaluating two different things, where the campus is concerned with sanctions on students, for example, whether they should be allowed to continue to be enrolled, or on faculty, whether they should remain on the faculty. And those are primarily civil determinations made in accordance with the disciplinary proceedings involving students and faculty. And it has a different level of proof and a different decision-making apparatus than the criminal justice system. That's not to say that there shouldn't be linkage and referral in cases, say, of rape to the criminal justice system. Particularly when the survivor indicates a willingness to undergo what happens on the criminal side, we do make those referrals.
And we thank Miriam for the call. I mentioned John Searle earlier, and I'm just wondering, because there's an advocacy group online that managed to get about 2,000 signatures that wants him to be fired, that also wants the campus center to take his name off of that and so forth. How do these things affect the whole adjudication process? I mean, obviously he's going to get his day in court, but, in the meantime, you got 2,000 signatures, maybe more forthwith.
Yeah, but I think the thing to keep in mind is that the campus has already taken interim measures, and he's not teaching or connection with students right now, and there needs to now to be time for a full and complete investigation, which is what the campus will do.
A listener who wants to know how you justify spending what is described by this listener as hundreds of millions to renovate Memorial Stadium. This funding has impact on the ability of UC to borrow and adversely affects research. And then the listener adds, go Bears.
Well, the decision to renovate Memorial Stadium was made prior to my time, and I gather it was made after evaluation of the options and out of a need to renovate the stadium. So there is a plan to recoup those monies, and we are hopeful that that plan will succeed.
Bring on another caller. Kat, join us. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm Kat from San Francisco. And I wondered if you could explain why the UC is not endorsing the March for Science at a time when science as a foundation for public policy is really under attack.
Well, we are not an official sponsor, in part because we don't have, any control over the event. But many of our students and faculty are on their way to D.C. now to participate in the march. And, I have been very upfront about the value of basic science research. In fact, I just did a LinkedIn post on that. This is central to the university, but it's also central to the United States and to our economy and indeed to the world. So you can't have a more passionate advocate for the value of basic research than myself.
A lot of that march was really galvanized by concern about climate change, and it continues to loom over the whole raison d'etre, in fact, for the moment.
Right, but we have a lot of students from UCSF who are in the medical sciences that are going back because health research is now impacted. All of science is, in a sense, under attack right now.
We did a whole program from the California Academy of Sciences, and you should hear the head of the California Academy of Sciences on this. He's taken a leadership role, in fact, on it. And I'm going to take some more calls. Let me go next to Livermore. Christine, you're on.
Oh, hi. I would just like to say thank you. My son is a freshman at Berkeley. He's doing fabulously. I'm a single mother. I'm a social worker. He's gotten scholarships and Pell Grants, and it's just been an amazing experience. He has an internship this summer, and I just couldn't be more pleased, and we just really need to continue to value our public education. So thank you so much.
Can hear your pride, and thank you for that call.
Thank you, and good luck to your son.
Yeah, good luck indeed. Here's Donald in Wenzel. Can you please explain to me why it makes sense to offshore IT at UCSF? Is it solely for cost reasons? If that's the case, why not search for low-cost professors, administrators, and even chancellors for greater savings?
This was a contract that was entered into by UCSF and a company called HCL to handle kind of backroom IT. It doesn't affect patients or patient care. And it was done because UCSF, as an academic medical center, is under continued pressure to keep costs down. And it was viewed as a cost-saving measure. So it will recoup about $30 million in savings. And those are savings that can be reinvested in the academic and teaching mission of the school.
And here's a caller with maybe an impresario idea. Vern, you want to get Robert Rice debating Ann Coulter? Is that right?
Yes. President Napolitano, I know you have no small amount of influence, and Robert Rice is clearly an amazing genius. And by the way, I just want to make one plug for the Bowles Hall private campus residential hall. Our daughter's living there now and absolutely loves it.
Well, I don't know if that's in your bailiwick, getting a debate between Robert Rice and Ann Coulter.
Right, right. But some campuses are doing is they are doing counter-programming when they have a particularly controversial speaker so that students have a choice on what speaker they want to attend.
Certainly what we try to do. I mean, in terms of the what comes out in the wash, as we used to say. Here's Sean from Oakland. Sean, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I went to UC Berkeley and paid about $600 a quarter, I think. It was back in 85. And I've listened to other shows that you guys did, and I still don't get it. I've even done research trying to figure out why is it so expensive. And I like simple answers, but maybe it's a very complex thing. Is it that we live in a world today where people in California aren't willing to pay the taxes that it would take to do the Bernie Sanders UC system?
The tuition at the University of California has increased almost in direct relation to the decrease in state appropriation to the University of California. So when you went, the state bore the bulk of the cost of your education. Now, unfortunately, students bear more of the cost. Now, we have very generous financial aid so that, in point of fact, almost half of our students graduate with no debt. And those who have debt, on the average, it's much lower than the national debt amount. But nonetheless, it is a matter of what is the priority of the state and where does the state want to invest its dollars. And I'm a big advocate for the UC and for public higher education. And I think the state of California benefits enormously by having the University of California. So anything we can do to increase that state investment, I'm all for.
And a listener wants to know, how do you feel about Bernie Sanders' idea of college for all?
Well, it leaves open the question, and I raised it when he made his initial proposal. Well, who is going to pay for it, and how do we make sure that in the race to have free college, we aren't providing tax dollars to families who really don't need it, and also B, that we are properly supporting primarily our research universities, which are more expensive to operate. And that produce themselves jobs and innovations and creativity. And the UC has benefited California enormously in this regard.
Number of questions from listeners. Let's see if we can go to them one after another here. Karen says, are you considering opening new campuses in the rest of California?
No, we're not. But what we are doing is building out the Merced campus so that we will have 10,000 students there by the year 2020. And we are looking at ways of education that do not necessarily require, you know, full-time residential presence on campus. So, for example, being able to spend part of your undergraduate time in London or Washington or Sacramento trying to expand our presence that way.
Another listener says, how about capping salaries of administrators, including presidents and regents, to limit administrative creep?
We live in a competitive world, and we want the best leaders and the best chancellors, and not everybody can be a chancellor. It requires a highly varied skill set, and we pay our chancellors in comparison to the market for university leaders. We are paying them near the bottom already, so again, to get the kind of leaders we want, we pay the kind of salaries we need to pay.
Here's a tweet from Beth, who writes, Napolitano 2020. It's refreshing to hear articulate, focused responses based on fact. Thinking about that at all?
No, but that's a compliment, I think.
That's a very nice compliment, yeah. You're here to stay for the time being, yeah?
I am, yes.
Would you consider running for elective office again, though?
No, I really am invested in being the president of the university.
Let's bring another caller on here, and we go to Santa Clara. Mustafa, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have a little sister who's applying to Berkeley, and she was really excited about the idea until she talked to her friend, and she's concerned that what she hears is that Berkeley is ruthless and that the academics, people don't want to help each other, and that she said you should go to Davis instead. I'm wondering how aware of the academic pressures you are, and if that's the kind of environment you'd want to have.
There's no doubt that Berkeley is academically demanding, but we just had a caller whose son is a freshman and is having a great experience. And so I think that the majority of our students at Berkeley are happy and they're striving and they're thriving. And but you are right. Each of our campuses has a different personality and a different character to it. And I would recommend that your little sister? Visit each campus and see where she feels more comfortable.
Good luck to her and to you. Thank you, Mustafa. We'll try to get another caller on here, and that's Becky. Becky, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, why doesn't the UC system expand their engineering schools to allow more enrollment, since there's a lot of kids in California who qualify but who can't get in, and we have such a need for engineers.
Right. So we would like to expand our colleges of engineering. In fact, I was just I had a conversation with the dean of the College of Engineering at Berkeley. The question is space and facilities and cost of providing that kind of education. And so, you know, right now we're not in a position to do such an expansion, but we're looking and we're exploring avenues to do so.
We've got just seconds left here, but this is a question from Bella. Says University Village tenants are enjoying the largesse of Albany residents because UC doesn't pay any property taxes, yet the children of UC's graduate students and fellows are attending Albany public schools. Then we pay taxes to support UC and our kids can't get admitted. It's a double whammy. Can you respond?
Well, I think the questioner is unhappy, but again, we work very closely with the communities in which we have housing and other things in order to mitigate that.
President Napolitano, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to have you, and hope we see you in the not-too-distant future, and stay healthy.
You bet.
Janet Napolitano is president of the University of California. When we come back, we're going to meet the author of a new novel called American War. Omar El-Akkad will be joining us in studio. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.